We are back on the record to continue the cross of Sir Michael Rutter.
Your Honor, if I may, just before we start the cross, there's one matter that I wanted to clear up on the record, and that has to do with Dr. Pardo, because there were twice, I think, there were comments about Dr. Pardo not being called by the government today, and I want to clarify on the record what transpired following the close of our on-the-record proceeding on Friday, which was that we indicated that Dr. Pardo was available to testify today and offered that he would be available for cross-examination about the contents of his letter or his report in that off-the-record conference with the court and petitioner's counsel. They indicated that they did not desire to cross-examine him on those matters. They also indicated that to the extent respondent would be asking Dr. Pardo to offer an opinion beyond what is in his letter or in his article, that would constitute expert opinion in their view, and that they were entitled to a written report of that in advance. And it was in light of those representations that Dr. Pardo is not here today.
I just wish they could have told us that on Friday, because when we left here Friday, we were under the impression that we were not allowed to contact Dr. Pardo because they had retained him and that he was going to show up today and testify. So we actually did a lot of work over the weekend to prepare to cross-examine Dr. Pardo, and it was only yesterday that they told us they had decided not to call him.
I'm not sure what kind of work would be necessary if all he was going to be discussing was his article, which has been referenced numerous times by petitioner's counsel and their experts, and his letter, which is a page and a half.
Any further comment, Mr. Williams?
Nope.
Thank you. To continue the cross, please.
Dr. Rutter, before we get into the ecological studies that you cite in your report and a couple controlled epidemiological studies of a cohort nature, I wonder if, do you know why we don't have any randomized control trial data on thimerosal vaccines and outcomes?
As far as I know, it's not been proposed.
You didn't know that there actually was a randomized trial in Italy that was done where a few thousand kids got thimerosal-containing DTP vaccines and several thousand kids didn't. They got non-thimerosal-containing vaccines. Other than that trial, are you aware of any other randomized trial on thimerosal?
No, I'm not aware.
In your opinion, would it be ethical today to do a randomized controlled trial on American children with thimerosal-containing vaccines for half of them and thimerosal-free vaccines for the other half?
Well, I think it would be ethical in the sense that there are no demonstrated risks associated with thimerosal. Whether it would be sensible, given the lack of evidence, to spend the time and money and resources to do a randomized controlled trial, I doubt.
There was never any suggestion that thimerosal improved the immunization effectiveness of the vaccines, was there?
No. It's a preservative.
Okay. Are you aware of any epidemiological study done on to look at the association between thimerosal-containing vaccines and regressive autism?
Not as such.
Let's talk about the Verstraten study. You mentioned it in your direct and you discuss it in your report. I think you said one of the strengths of that Verstraten study was the large numbers of children that were?
Sure.
About 140,000 children in that study?
Yeah.
Do you know what Dr. Verstraten himself has said about that study in the published literature?
Yes, he has said that he regards it as inconclusive.
Well, let's see if that's exactly what he said. Let me show you a petitioner's reference, master reference number 19. I'll give you a copy.
Okay, thank you.
Now, this is a letter that Dr. Verstraeten wrote to the journal in which his study had been published, correct?
Yes.
And I don't know if we know the date of this letter. Scott, do you know the date of this? It doesn't have a date on this page.
Followed shortly after the article. I don't remember the exact date.
April 2004 is the reference. And if you'd highlight the top right-hand column, the top of the right-hand column, Scott, about middle of the, maybe a little bit further down there, and blow that up. You see where he says, surprisingly, however, the study is being interpreted now as negative by many, including the anti-vaccine lobbyists? Now, is your characterization of this study as negative?
As I said, he describes it as inconclusive, and he does so because of the wide confidence interval.
Well, no, I'm asking what your characterization of it is. Do you think it's a negative study, or is it an inconclusive study?
The studies can't be divided up quite like that. What you have to ask is there any evidence from this study and others using a range of strategies that is in support? And the answer is no. This is not in support.
He goes on to say, a neutral study carries a very distinct message. The investigators could neither confirm nor exclude an association, and therefore more study is required. Do you agree with that? That more study in this vaccine safety data link database is required?
At the time that statement was made, that might be correct. But since then, we've got a number of other studies, all of which fail to show any association, so that I would no longer regard that as appropriate. This was 4 years ago, remember.
That's right. Did you know that in 2006, the NIH convened a panel of experts on autism and epidemiology to consider whether additional studies within the vaccine safety data link could and should be done that would be informative on the question of the association between dimerosal vaccines and autism?
No, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that. Well, let me show you that briefly and ask you if you agree with their recommendations or not. This is petitioner's master reference list 5x3.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of us have seen this before, Doctor, so let me just represent to you that that's the signature on the first page of the director of NIH, and it was in October of 2006 when this was released. And if you could just pull up, Scott, the highlights that we had in there on what the committee recommended be done. You haven't seen this report before, Dr.
No.
Rutter?
No, I haven't.
It says that one possibility that generated support by the panel, they're talking about possible studies that could be done, was an expansion of the VSD study published by Verstraeten. And by expansion, I think it's fair to say they were talking about both an expansion in time forward to the point where a lot of the children had not been exposed to thimerosal, as well as an expansion geographically to additional HMOs within the system. Because I think even one of the criticisms you made of the Verstraeten original study was that it only had three HMOs in it, and one of them was very small, right? So would you agree with this expert panel in October of 2006 that it would be a good thing to do to expand this Verstraeten study time-wise and geographically?
You've got to remember I come from the UK, and with the Availability of funds in the UK, I would have to say there is not sufficient evidence, in my view, to justify spending British money doing an expanded study. I realise the US has much more money, and if it in its wisdom wished to expand, fine. But the situation now, I think, is where there are sufficient studies with different strategies coming to the same conclusion that I wouldn't want my taxpayers' money used in that way.
Let's turn to the, you can take that down, Scott. Let's turn to your discussion of some of these ecological studies you mentioned. Now, the heron study you discuss on page 44 of your report, that was one of these prospective cohort studies, correct?
Correct.
Now, you said in your report, and isn't this a fair criticism of the study, that it didn't have autism as an endpoint.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
Okay.
Correct.
You have to have an audible answer for the record.
Oh, I'm That's sorry. I'm sorry.
I knew what you were doing, but right. the audience didn't. And it also was a fairly small study, right? Only 14,000 children.
Yes.
Wouldn't be reasonably able to detect a change in autism rates among that small group of children, would you?
Well, in that it's a single cohort, you couldn't look at change anyway. You could only look at associations, yes.
But the confidence intervals would be enormous, wouldn't they? Right. And then, and yet you think that you can take that study and add it to the rest of them, and it gives weight to them, nevertheless, right?
I didn't give much weight to it, as you will realize from what I put in the report. There are too many limitations on it for me to wish to place much weight. I note that it is a good epidemiological study. I have no criticisms on that, but the reasons you've given that there isn't a specific focus on autism and its sample size is on the small side, studies of this kind, I wouldn't place much weight on it, and I didn't.
Now, on page 44 of your report, in discussing the ecological studies in general, in paragraph 75, and let's pull up paragraph 75 of his report and discuss it for a second. You're talking about one of the limitations in the cohort studies is that there is little variation in the total amount of thimerosal received.
Right.
Now, why is that a weakness in the cohort studies?
Well, because the opportunity to find an effect is, of course, very much related to the degree of variation in what is your independent variable. So that, to go to an extreme, you can't look at the effects of thimerosal if everybody gets the same dose at the same time. By extending that argument a little bit further, if the variation either in the timing or in the dose is very small, the chance of detecting an effect is equally limited.
Now, if you try to solve that problem by combining a group of children who were exposed to thimerosal in, say, years 1, 2, and 3, and then thimerosal is removed, and now in years 5, 6, and 7, you have no exposure. Don't you still have a problem because you're not measuring the rates at the same point in time? Isn't that also a weakness in a study?
I'm not quite sure what study you're referring to. So I'm not. I mean, is anybody done that?
Well, I thought you cited several studies that had done that in your report. The Scandinavian studies that looked at a point in time when thimerosal was in the vaccines and another point in time when it was out.
Yes.
My question is, doesn't that, though, add some potential confounders that wouldn't be there if you could look at different doses at the same point in time?
No, but as I tried to point out, each of the designs has got its own particular strengths and limitations. The advantages of the ecological designs, looking at time trends, comes especially because their one big strength is that there is a firm prediction of what should happen when thimerosal is discontinued. That's its strength. Its limitation is that you can't look at it on an individual case basis. If you look at the cohort studies, you have the opposite set of strengths and limitations. There, you can look at it on in terms of what the individual has received, and you can control for confounders much better because you have individual data, but you can't look at changes over time. So this comes back to the main point I was trying to make in my report, which is that you're foolish always to rely on one single type of design. The strength comes from looking at a number of different designs, each of which has particular strengths, but equally each has particular weaknesses. Now, if a varied range of designs give you a varied set of answers, then you are in difficulty in knowing what to conclude. If, however, despite their variations in strategies, they come up with a broadly similar answer, that gives one confidence that the positive or negative conclusion, as the case may be, is more likely to be solid.
Let's turn to the Young-Guyer study, which is Petitioner's Exhibit 665.
Yep.
This study has 278,000 children in it, correct? Right?
Something like that, yes.
Much larger than the Verstraten study.
Yes.
And much larger than any of the other ecological studies that you cited.
Yes.
Isn't that a strength of the study?
No, let me talk about the study in a bit more detail, because quite frankly, I think it's a poor study. And it's a poor study for several different reasons. To begin with, it starts off with a cohort design, so that, as I understand it, they have records on individuals that they could follow forward. But they don't actually analyze the data that way. What they do is they analyze it in terms of time trends. And in order to do that, they have to make various adjustments with the first cohort and the last cohort, so that you're dealing with a strange design, which is putting together chalk and cheese and the hope of gazpacho soup coming out, to use a rather mixed analogy.
Well, let me ask you, do you know whether they were allowed to look at individual?
Of course not. I haven't discussed it with them.
What?
No, of course I don't know that, because I haven't discussed it with them. All I've got is in the paper. So it is poor from that point of view. I think that their analytic design and strategy was not a satisfactory one. In terms of conclusions, if one turns to table 3, the thing that is really striking is that you have a significant effect, using effect now not in a causal sense, but a statistical effect.
Yes.
With a really quite heterogeneous range of disorders. So that if the, let's take the neuroinflammation hypothesis as the one that we were talking about before the break, is correct, it is dealing with the most significant effect on tics and on disturbances of emotions. So one would have to suppose that if this is seen as supportive, you're getting a neural effect that is going across a range of disorders of extremely heterogeneous kind, with different ages of onset, with different genetic factors involved, with different courses, so that the very major lack of specificity would make me immediately skeptical as to what it shows.
But they did use control disorders of pneumonia, congenital anomalies, and failure to thrive, didn't they?
Well, yes, they did. But why are they there and disturbance of emotions not there?
Well, the data is the data.
Exactly. The disturbance of emotions should have been a control disorder.
Well, even if it had been in the controls, if they found an association, they'd have to report an association.
Exactly.
And they reported what they found.
Exactly.
What's wrong with reporting what you find?
The inferences you draw from it. Control disorders, I mean, I don't know what the basis of control disorders choice was, but I would have thought that anybody who knows anything about the field at all would have put disturbances of emotions as a control disorder.
Well, but even if they put it down there, if they've got the data that come out the way it is, they have to report what they found.
Yeah, exactly. And what you'd have to show then is that you have an effect that is even more significant with a control disorder than you do with a neurodevelopmental disorder. The disturbance of emotions is not, by anybody that I know of, regarded as a neurodevelopmental disorder.
Well, whether they classified it as a neurodevelopmental disorder or not, It's an ICD-9 code. They look and see whether it's associated statistically with this difference in exposure, and they found that it was. What's wrong with finding that and reporting it?
Because their postulate is that it is found with neurodevelopmental disorders, and it is not classified by ICD-10 or DSM-4 or any psychiatrist either side of the Atlantic that I'm aware of as a neurodevelopmental disorder.
So you're quibbling with whether they... You're not quibbling with the data that they found. You're just quibbling with how they characterized it before they started the study.
Well, I quibble with both. I mean, I think changing it from what could have been a cohort design into a somewhat artificial time trends design, I mean, that doesn't seem to be a scientifically sensible thing to do.
You think that they should not have looked at emotional disorders at all? They should have just left that out?
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, then what are you saying?
I'm saying that the control disorders, which are defined as non-neurodevelopmental, should include all the non-neurodevelopmental disorders. Emotional disorders, by the opinion of anybody that I've ever heard of, either side of the Atlantic, and the official classifications, and the empirical research evidence, is not a neurodevelopmental disorder. And therefore, to include it as supportive rather than contradictory is against the strategy.
But you're not disputing right now that that's what the data show. However they categorized it, if they look at that ICD-9 code and find these statistics, they have to report it, don't they?
That's not the point I'm making. I'll make it once more, and then I really refuse to answer any more questions on it. The point is that they have created two groups, one of neurodevelopmental disorders and one of non-neurodevelopmental disorders. What is wrong is that in the neurodevelopmental disorders, they have included a condition that nobody but nobody would regard as neurodevelopmental. Therefore, the comparison between these two groups has to be invalid.
But there's a lot of neurodevelopmental disorders they don't have. They didn't look at, right? They couldn't possibly look at all of them. Could they? I mean, realistically, in ICD-9, aren't there just pages and pages and pages of neurodevelopmental disorders?
This is not what they've left out, it's what they've put in.
Do you agree that the fact that they had large groups of children with 100 microgram exposure difference is a strength of the study?
I don't know why they took that particular cutoff. That's not explained.
Yeah, I think it is. If you look on page 5 of the paper, in the right-hand column, let's go through this just so we can understand this. Just above the figure, Scott, if you'd highlight the finally paragraph.
Yeah, it describes what has happened over time, yeah.
Well, what they say here, Doctor, just to summarize it, is that there was a period of time in 92 and 93 in this country when there were two types of DTP vaccines being used. And some of them were combined with the HIB vaccine in such a way that a lot of children only got 4 shots because they were combined and therefore only got 100 micrograms, 25 per shot, whereas another large group got separate shots and got 8 shots and got 200 micrograms. And they were able to take advantage of that large difference to see if there was any association. And isn't that a strength of the study that isn't present in any of the other ecological studies that we have?
No, I don't see it as a strength. I mean, the problem is that unless you've got a hypothesis which says something testable about what level of exposure the effects come, it is entirely arbitrary to change it in terms of what particular mix happens. So, no, I don't regard that as a strength.
You don't think it's reasonable to look to see in a database that allows it if there's a difference in association between neurodevelopmental disorders and 100 microgram difference in exposure?
What I'm saying is that it's arbitrary in the absence of a hypothesis as to what sort of level of difference matters. So that one of the real problems in trying to look at the literature as a whole here is that there is a complete lack of specificity as to whether, for example, the European studies are relevant or not relevant because the dosage of thimerosal is lower in the European vaccines than it has been in the American vaccines. So it keeps changing, as it were, as to what seems to suit the case being made.
All right, pull that down. Have you looked at the terbutaline papers that we've discussed in this trial for the last 2 weeks?
Sorry, the what papers?
Do you know about the Connors twin study done at Johns Hopkins on twins and siblings exposed to terbutaline in preterm labor?
I don't think I do know that.
You're not familiar with that at all?
I don't think so.
You're not familiar with the follow-up animal study they did that found that in animals, terbutaline provoked neuroinflammation in the brains of the animals?
I think that's not a literature I've looked at.
I want to ask you about a study that you did cite. You cite on page 41 of your report a study from Hong Kong by Ip et al.
Yep.
If you could pull up paragraph 71, Scott, and blow up the first 6 or 7 lines of that paragraph 71. It's coming up. This is you discussing IP. You say that, more importantly, the basic findings with respect to a lower level of mercury in the hair of children with autism have not been confirmed in a study from Hong Kong. A cross-sectional study of both hair and blood mercury levels of 82 children with an ASD and a mean age of about 7 years were compared with normal group of children, control group of normal children. no differences were found between either the blood or hair mercury levels of the two groups, and therefore this evidence runs counter to the suggestion of a causal relationship between mercury and ASD. Now, are you aware that this study has been reanalyzed?
I am.
You just didn't catch that before you wrote the report?
Correct.
Do you agree now that based on the reanalysis, which found a positive statistical association between blood levels and autism, that this study now points toward a causal association rather than away from it?
No, I don't. There are two key things. Firstly, I don't think I've got that paper with me. No, I haven't. Okay, if you can fish it out. To begin with, reanalysis by the group shows a significance level of 0.056. And the critique argues that they should have said that's nearly significant. That actually, of course, isn't the way things work in statistics. If you're going to take a cutoff, then whether it's just above the cutoff is not relevant. That is why statisticians nowadays tend to prefer confidence intervals rather than a set statistical level. But the other problem is that the critique argues that a one-tailed test should have been employed. Now, a one-tailed test means that you are looking at a finding only in one direction, and that if it comes in the opposite direction, you ignore it. But the problem here is that that isn't the case, so that the literature now dealing with a range of studies here sometimes point in one direction and sometimes another. So to have done a one-tailed test would have been statistically quite inappropriate. So what we land up with is a study that fails to show an association. You could argue that the significance level comes close, if you like, but it doesn't point in the opposite direction.
Let me show you the results section here, the first paragraph of the results section, because I think there may be a misunderstanding. This is petitioner's exhibit, master reference list 423.
Right.
This is the paper by DeSoto and Hitland, entitled Blood Levels of Mercury Are Related to Diagnosis of Autism, a Reanalysis of an Important Data Set.
Yeah.
And by the way, this reanalysis was published in the year 2007.
Yes.
And you wrote your report in 2008, and you just failed to detect this.
Well, I have read the paper. I hadn't read it at the time I wrote my report. That's quite true.
Well, let's look what the p-value is in the relationship between blood and mercury. Mercury blood levels in autism in the results section. The first paragraph says, logistic regression was performed using blood mercury level as the predictor and the autistic control group as the criterion. Results of this reanalysis indicate that blood mercury level can be used to predict autism diagnosis with a p-value of 0.017. Now, that's a statistically significant association, isn't it, Doctor?
Yes, it is. But if we go on, let me find it. As the original authors have now currently calculated, this is the bottom of page 1310, the obtained difference suggests it's probably a real difference with a probability that this counts is true of 94%, i.e. A p-value of 0.06 misses the conventional mark. Given the close value, most researchers would not call this a firm rejection of the hypothesis, but might say it was marginally significant.
Wait, I've lost you. Where are you reading from?
Bottom of page 1310, top of page 1311.
That's about hair, isn't it? I was asking you about blood levels. There's another exchange that I didn't want to take the time to go into about the hair levels. But Dr. Ashner wrote a letter criticizing this paper for not analyzing the hair levels property, and then DeSoto and Hitlin responded to Ashner and said, no, you misunderstood us. Even the hair data supports us. I didn't want to go into that. Have you read those? Have you read that exchange of letters?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Then let me ask you one other about one other study you cite in your report.
Mm-hmm.
On page 40, paragraph 69, you talk about these studies of autism rates in relation to coal-fired power plants that release mercury into the air, and you. You criticize the Palmer paper in paragraph 69, which by saying there are no data on how environmental release of mercury actually gets into the body, and hence there's no way of telling whether the mercury effect should be considered likely to be restricted to the county within which the industrial output existed. Now, do you know that Palmer has published an updated study of this same effect?
No.
Where he takes into account the distance from the power plant?
Well, no, I don't know that, but I will come back to similar studies in relation to lead, which I was concerned with, 30 years ago. And the point made then was that if... toxins, in this case they were talking about lead rather than mercury, are released into the atmosphere. The question as to how they get into the body is a key feature. And that if they are getting into the body through being deposited on foods, the effect is much broader than you'd expect from where they live. And so that doing the analysis by area actually is not a very good way of doing it, quite apart from the fact that you're dealing here with a dispersal which has got really nothing to do with thimerosal. But my main point here is that you've got to know the route into the body to know whether the effect is area-specific or not. And they haven't done that.
Let me show you the updated study. It's okay. Petitioner's master reference list 560. This is what they call a pre-edited final edit publication. That happens with some of your papers too, doesn't it, sometimes, where they release the pre-publication version even before you finally edited all the copy, and then you have a chance to correct it before it actually appears in the final journal?
Well, that is unusual if it hasn't gone through review before that. There is now in many journals internationally, journals that are put online after they have gone through full review and correction before they're printed on paper. But is that what we're talking about here?
Well, this is... Let me just show you the paragraph at the bottom of this first page, because this study has gone through peer review.
Okay.
And it's been accepted for publication. And then they say, as a service to our customers, we are providing this early version of the manuscript. The manuscript will undergo copy editing, typesetting, and review of the resulting galley proof before it's published in its final citable form.
Okay.
But the paper has gone through peer review and been accepted, right?
Okay.
Okay. And let's just quickly go, if you go to just above the methods section, Scott, on page 5 of this exhibit. This pull up this part of the paragraph, if you would. Dr. Palmer is discussing here the various papers that you discussed, the Wyndham study from California, and Palmer's previous paper of 2006 that you cite.
Yeah.
And he says, the Wyndham study and my study demonstrated that environmental mercury pollution was associated with point prevalence estimates of autism using EPA-reported mercury release data from 254 counties in Texas. A major limitation to this study was that the cross-sectional design precluded any causal inferences. In addition, exposure was inferred from total pounds of environmentally released mercury aggregated at the county level at a specific point in time. Using distance to potential exposure sources may be a more reasonable proxy for exposure than one defined by total amounts, by amount totals contained within the artificial county boundaries. So the criticism that you made in your paragraph 69, where it says that the mercury effect should be considered likely to be restricted to the county within which the industrial output existed, Palmer's group is now trying to fix that problem by measuring proximity to the source as a new variable in the study. You agree?
It seems so.
In fact, he says at the bottom line of that same paragraph, Scott, the next paragraph, if you can pull it up just a little bit, and highlight that. Right above methods, it says, the objective of the current study is to determine if proximity to major sources of mercury pollution are related to autism prevalence rates. Now, let's go to the results section, which is on page 8 of this exhibit. Excuse me, page 7, Scott. It starts at the very bottom of page 7. And I just want to blow up that paragraph there, the results, for a second. And he's talking about different models that he used, but he says right here, model 1A shows that environmentally released mercury in 1998 is significantly associated with autism rates in 2002. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a reasonable time frame, assuming that the exposure is by inhalation of mercury vapor from these plants by infants in 1998? Would it be reasonable that you would be able to pick up diagnoses of autism 4 years later?
Yes, probably.
And then he says that they worked with this coefficient to come up with an incident risk ratio. The last sentence of this page, Scott, and then carry over, says the coefficient yields an incident risk ratio of 1.026, indicating that for every 1,000 pounds, now we're at the top of the next page, there we go, that for every 1,000 pounds of release in 1998, there is a corresponding 2% increase in 2002 autism rates. And then they try to take into account the number of pounds, And then finally, they add distance in Model 1C. This is the point I want to make and ask you about. It says, adding distance to the equation in Model 1C shows that for every 10 miles away from the source, there is a decreased autism incident risk of 1.4%. Now, doesn't that fix the county limitation that you were criticizing in the first version of this study?
Not really. If we turn to page 10, where the limitations of the study are outlined, you see several important features. To begin with, the conclusions about exposure are not based on the distance from individual homes, but from school district centroids of various sizes, so that it's not an accurate distance. And the further point I made is that you don't know about the route by which the mercury gets into the body, and that obviously depends on all sorts of things and matters. And what it says is the study should be viewed as hypothesis generating, not as proving anything one way or the other.
Well, isn't virtually every study hypothesis generating?
Not at all.
Some studies just end the question, no further study needed.
No, that's not the point being, that's not what's meant by hypothesis generating. There are studies which, as it were, raise a possibility. Let me come back to the fenfluramine and secretin examples I used earlier. So we stick within the area of autism. So fenfluramine was based on a hypothesis generating study which suggested that fenfluramine, because it was known to lower serotonin levels, was a reasonable candidate for doing further studies. That was then followed by hypothesis testing studies that were different in the sense that they, first of all, looked to see whether fenfluramine had effects on autism symptoms. So this was done in a way in which these were quantified. And secondly, it was done by relating whether, insofar as there were benefits, and there were very few, insofar as there were benefits, was it associated with the degree to which the serotonin levels had fallen? And the answer is they were not. So this was a hypothesis testing study which used an earlier hypothesis generating study in order to do it in a way which could either confirm the hypothesis or it could refute the hypothesis. In the event, it refuted the hypothesis, but it could have worked either way. So it's a quite different form of study. Hypothesis generating is what comes first. Hypothesis testing is what comes next.
So if someone is trying to decide whether it's biologically plausible that mercury exposure can lead to autism in some children, would you have them just ignore this Palmer study, or would you have them put some weight on it?
I wouldn't put much weight on it. I think that when you're planning a new study, you look very broadly and you pay attention to all sorts of things. But I wouldn't put much weight on it. But would I put some? Well, yes. It's an interesting finding insofar as it goes, but doesn't take one very far, I think.
Do you recall there was a point in your report where you said that on the question of whether thimerosal-containing vaccines are associated with regressive autism, that question is susceptible to being studied in a rigorous way?
Yes.
What did you mean? How could you study that in a rigorous way?
Can you direct me to?
Well, I thought I could. I was trying. I frankly can't now find. Let me see if I can find the quote.
Here we are, para 92.
Okay.
So what I say, let me read it out because it's quite short. I say it would have been possible to test the regression hypothesis in a vigorous way. I actually should mean rigorous, a typo that has escaped my attention.
I read it as rigorous too.
For example, cases involving regression and those apparently without regression could be compared, blind to the knowledge on regression, on the presence of multiple congenital physical anomalies, because they will have had to have arisen prenatally. And the advantage of such an approach is that it would not be reliant on anyone's recognition of the behavioral changes in the first year of life. And the same thing could be done in relation to head size. So those are two strategies. They're not the only ones. But the point is that having had a exploratory approach put forward that suggested something, what you need to do is to think, what design can I use that could either prove or refute that hypothesis? And that's what singularly has not been done. But it could have been done.
And are you critical of the families that have brought these claims for not having done such studies?
I'm never blaming the families, because when orthodox medicine doesn't have answers that will bring cures for their children, they look around for possible explanations. They look around for people who have things to offer. Now, I don't blame the parents at all. It's the scientists.
Just one last quick topic, Dr. Rutter. You started working with the thimerosal, with the vaccine manufacturers on the thimerosal litigation, you said, about 4 years ago. And then you say in your report that you started working on the MMR litigation a year before that.
Yes.
Is that about right? So probably sometime in 2003.
Probably must be something like that, yeah. May have been earlier.
Now, in 2005, you published a paper in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry on the effect of MMR withdrawal in a population in Japan.
Yes.
You remember that paper?
Yes.
Now, I don't know what you did, but there is no disclosure on the paper that you had already been retained by vaccine manufacturers to work on the MMR litigation, even though the subject of the paper is MMR. Did you make a disclosure about that?
Presumably I didn't, as it isn't in the paper. But of course I hadn't completed a report at all, and the data were all collected and analyzed by Honda, not by myself.
Didn't you just testify recently in a hearing in the UK against Andy Wakefield, where the issue is whether he had made a proper disclosure of his conflict of interest?
I did indeed, but that is in somewhat different circumstances, in that he was presenting results of his analysis on his cases and claiming a particular causal effect.
Well, didn't you claim in this? Let's introduce this paper into evidence. This will be trial exhibit.
It's a much more indirect connection. But if you're suggesting that it would have been reasonable that I had made that explicit, I wouldn't have any objection to that. I mean, I didn't occur to me at the time. And there are reasons why I think it wasn't directly relevant, but it was certainly no attempt to conceal it.
You think you're not as tempted by conflicts of interest as other scientists?
Some are, some aren't.
Thank you.
Any green draft? Let me clarify. Did petitioner intend to introduce that last document as
yes.
an exhibit?
Okay. As exhibit 10?
Number 10.
Yes.
Okay.
The only reason for asking for that is because there are two papers that Dr. or Professor Rutter was asked to look at, and we just want to have him have a chance to look through them. He hadn't seen them before, in case he has any comments that might be enlightening for the court.
Let me take a look to see what time we're actually, just for the record. We are just about at 3 o'clock, so let's go till 3:10.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a brief recess.